This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's time for Cookies and Crime. Hey everyone, it's Karen T, and welcome back to another episode of Cookies and Crime. Before I get started, I have some super exciting news. I was recently on a baking show. It's a baking show I've been on before. It's Food Network's Christmas Cookie Challenge. And 2 years ago, I competed and I won. This season, I'm coming back as a winner, competing against other returning winners for another chance at $10,000 and the title of the best of the best. This was a very interesting competition because I had a teammate this time around, which I've never baked with anyone before. And if you are someone who loves to cook and bake, you know how hard it is to share the kitchen. Regardless, I had such an amazing time, and I would love for you guys to watch and support. So the episode comes out November 16th at 9 p.m., 8 p.m. Central. If you have cable, you can watch it on Food Network. You can also catch it on YouTube TV and Discovery Plus. You can also watch my previous episode on Discovery Plus, and all of this information will be in the episode's description. And since we're already on the topic of cookies, I'm going to dive into this episode's cookie. So I have a cookie from Magnolia's Bakery, and it's a red velvet bread pudding cookie. I mean, how amazing does that sound? This cookie has been in a freezer for 2 weeks and flew with me from LA back to home in Portland, and now I finally get to eat it. If you have never heard of Magnolia's Bakery, just know they have some of the best bread pudding I have ever had. Ooh, this one's cakey. First of all, I did not do a good job of storing this cookie because I do taste freezer, but even with that, I cannot stop eating this cookie. The texture is, I think, my favorite texture in a cookie. It's almost like a cake. It is so soft. If I had some vanilla ice cream right now, I would be in heaven. This cookie is like a 7.5 out of 10. I definitely still prefer bread pudding in bread pudding form, but this cookie hits. I literally cannot stop putting this in my mouth. Okay. So in this episode, I'm going to be covering the case from Netflix's documentary, Take Care of Maya. This case was ongoing up until today when I recorded this intro. So at the end of the episode, I do give an update. What I will say about this case and this documentary is that it is freaking gut-wrenching. I have not broke down from a documentary in such a long time. And even now, I'm just choking up thinking about it because this documentary was so moving and the people involved, oh my gosh, my heart goes out to them and you cannot help but feel bad for them. And I wanted to cover this case because I wanted to bring awareness around this because this affects a lot of families in the US. This case is not just about the people involved, it is about getting justice for all of the families that have been affected by the same thing and by the same people. And I hope by all of us collectively bringing awareness to this case, that systems change in the future so this never ever happens again. This is also good information to know if you ever find yourself in this type of position. So with that, let's jump into the case. This is the case from Take Care of Maya. Beata Kowalski was born in Polish People's Republic and immigrated to the US when she was 16. She became a registered infusion nurse and went on to marry Jack Kowalski. They would have 2 children together, Maya and Kyle. They lived in Venice, Florida.
Around the age of 10, Maya starts feeling unwell. It started off with breathing problems. She had headaches and blurry vision. Her skin felt like it was on fire, and she could barely walk. It was so bad, she would cry in the middle of the night from extreme pain. So what does any decent parent do? They take her to the doctor. But after seeking out several, none of them could tell them what was happening with Maya. They weren't given any firm diagnosis. Beata is determined to help her child. She leads with maternal instincts and uses her knowledge from her own job to assist her daughter. As a nurse, her mother was very thorough with documenting all the appointments and all the symptoms. She's taken an incredible amount of video and audio recordings in hopes of getting her daughter closer to better health. Her documentation would help her family in more ways than she could have imagined. After doing a ton of research, Beata comes across Dr. Anthony Kirkpatrick, an anesthesiologist. Anesthesiologists are typically known as the physicians who use anesthesia to put you to sleep before and during surgery or other medical procedures like removing your wisdom teeth. But they also relieve pain before, during, and after operations and treat chronic pain patients. So Beata and Maya pay him a visit, and it's recorded. Right away, he noticed how curled up her feet were, and he knew it was dystonia, which is a disorder that causes muscles to twist. It looks so bad, she couldn't put any weight on it. He asks her to raise her arm as far as she can, and it's not very far. And from her face, you can see she's trying her hardest, but she's in agony. After assessing her, he knew exactly what it was. Exactly. It was simple to him. Complex regional pain syndrome. CRPS is when pain from a physical trauma lasts longer than the expected recovery time. So for a person without it, like myself, if they were to accidentally twist their ankle, it would take 1 to 2 weeks to heal. But for someone with CRPS, the pain could possibly last indefinitely, likely for life. It also manifests in different ways unrelated to the original trauma due to nerve damage. It can restrict your range of motion and make a feather on your skin feel like burning or like you're being stabbed with a knife. CRPS is known as the world's most painful and incurable condition. The pain is so bad, it's also known as the suicide disease. The pain is among the highest recorded pain on the McGill pain scale. I know I just said pain like 1,000 times, but this whole syndrome is about really intense pain. The scale of the McGill pain scale goes from 0 to 50, and for reference, childbirth ranks around 35 to 41. The amputation of a finger or toe is around 40, and CRPS is at a 42. It increases dramatically from ages 9 to 11, and it mostly happens to girls. It's something that has existed in documents for about 100 years, but it was only recognized in modern medicine in the early 1990s. It's not a common syndrome. It's actually pretty rare. And at the time, and even now, not many doctors are familiar with it. So those with the syndrome are often told it's psychological or it's in their heads. This is what's affecting Maya, who at this point is 9 or 10 years old. This child is experiencing some of the worst pain most of us can't even imagine. And her mother is doing everything she can to help her daughter figure out what she has and how to relieve her pain. And what I admire about her mother is that even in her desperation and having to see her child suffer like this, she always remains strong for her daughter. You can just tell by the videos of her and her voice that she's trying her best to remain strong. Not in one of these videos or audio recordings do you hear her cry. Not to say that if you cry, you're not strong, but you can just tell that she's trying to stay strong for her daughter. So now they have this diagnosis, and one of the treatments for it is ketamine. You may have heard of it since it's also popular as a recreational drug. Ketamine was developed in the 1960s and it's primarily used as an anesthetic. It sedates the user and makes them feel calm and relaxed and relieves them from pain. It also distorts your perceptions of sight and sound and causes hallucinations. And that's probably why it became a popular club drug. So of course, with any medication that is a powerful pain reliever, it gets abused and it gets a bad rep. But with this scale of pain that CRPS can cause, ketamine is a viable treatment. So the Kowalskis try ketamine in low doses, but it's no match for the pain that Maya is feeling. So then, Dr. Kirkpatrick recommends a ketamine coma. Maya would be given a large dose of ketamine, which would induce a 5-day coma. This was considered experimental and very risky. There's a 50% chance that she could die. There have been studies done on this treatment which have proved successful, but apparently it's not a common treatment in the US. In order to get this treatment, the Kowalski family would have to go to Mexico. When I first heard this, I immediately think, this sounds a little sketch. I mean, going to Mexico to get a large amount of ketamine, I mean, that's what I think in my ignorance of understanding this treatment. But no, the treatment in Mexico is still under Dr. Kirkpatrick's watch. So Dr. Kirkpatrick had embarked on a study in Mexico with a protocol similar to that used in a German study regarding ketamine comas. He sends his patients to the San Jose Technological Hospital affiliated with the Tech de Monterrey School of Medicine in Monterrey, Mexico, a few hours drive from the Texas border. Patients have to pay about $20,000 for the treatment, which is not covered by insurance. The study was originally approved in the United States by the Institutional Review Boards of the University of South Florida and Tampa General Hospital, but the FDA refused to grant an exemption to its international new drug application. Rather than embark on a process that would likely cost $3 million and delay treatment for their patients, Dr. Kirkpatrick and his colleagues moved the study to Mexico. A review board in Monterrey also approved the study. Now, in this German study, 38 patients received treatment with the ketamine coma, and only half of them saw it as completely successful. All of them gained immediate relief, and it would last a few months or so, but for 55 to 60% of the patients, the pain returned. But at least 12 of the patients have had minimal or no pain for more than 5 years after their treatment. Hearing those statistics myself would be enough for me to try out that treatment, knowing what CRPS is and how much pain you can go through because of it. And it was enough hope for Maya and her family. So Maya goes to Mexico for the treatment, and it dramatically improves her situation. In a video footage, Maya and Beata go to Dr. Kirkpatrick for a checkup, and there's a light in her eyes compared to her last visit. She's able to put her arms behind her head without any trouble, which before, she could barely lift her hand above her head. But Maya's pain would be that of the 55 to 60% in that some of the pain comes back and takes some of the normalcy out of her life again. And at the same time, these treatments are expensive and they start to catch up with the family. The Kowalskis can't afford to continue with Dr. Kirkpatrick, so he recommends the family to Dr. Ashraf Hanna, who accepts their insurance and can provide a helpful dosage of ketamine for Maya. With this, she's able to live normally for a while. But then on October 7th, 2016, during Hurricane Matthew, Maya's intense pain relapses. She was screaming in pain and was begging for help. Her father, Jack, has no other option than to take his daughter to the emergency room while his wife is at work. He takes her to Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. When they arrive, the staff aren't really sure what's happening with Maya. When told she had complex regional pain syndrome, the first nurse had never heard of it. Neither did the others who were assigned to them. Beata, who is on her way home from work, knows her daughter's needs and prescriptions like the back of her hand. I mean, she writes every single thing down, how could she not? So Jack is on the phone with her at the hospital and hands the nurses the phone so they can talk to Beata. She tells the nurse what pain medication had been prescribed to Maya by her doctor. The nurses hear ketamine and note the dosage that was given to her and were shocked at how high it was. In their heads, they're thinking, why is this 10-year-old receiving this much of a painkiller, of ketamine? Being unfamiliar with CRPS, This raises some suspicion in them. So Beata arrives at the hospital. Again, Beata's a nurse, and from what I can tell by TikTok videos and friends who are nurses, it's a tough, demanding job. Add on having a child with CRPS and a mother's instinct to want their kids to, at the minimum, feel no pain, and a mother's rage in wanting to do whatever it takes to protect their child, this is all that Beata is holding as she walks into the hospital. The staff at the hospital don't like Beata's attitude. They described her as belligerent, demanding, and controlling. Beata tells them point blank they don't understand Maya's medical diagnosis, and they don't understand how much medicine it takes to control her pain. Which, in my opinion, I mean, where's the lie? It's true that they literally didn't know what CRPS was. And I don't think that every medical professional needs to know every single disease or syndrome in the world, but I feel like when you are unfamiliar with something, there has to be an expert in that field that you can consult. Or that knowing that they are not an expert in that syndrome or disease, that they might take their time in making assumptions or decisions about it. But the staff do not like this. They do not like being told medical information from someone that is a patient or a relative of the patient. I'm sure this hurts their egos. Someone is coming into their office and tells them they have no idea what they're doing when they probably believe they are the smartest person in that room. They are absolutely offended by what she's saying. I have no doubts about that. By the way, I am recording this in the morning bright and early, so I haven't had anything to really wake me up yet. So I'm gonna take my little magic mind real quick. If you haven't heard of Magic Mind, it's this little elixir shot with all the good stuff you want in your body and a healthy amount of caffeine, which is important for me. I don't drink coffee very often because it gives me so much anxiety now. And I find that Magic Mind has the right amount of caffeine that doesn't trigger my anxiety, but gives me this very energetic wakefulness feeling. Like I feel naturally awake, which is great. It has lion's mane, which I've been obsessed with because it's so good for the brain and memory. There's also ashwagandha that's known for decreasing stress. I like to recommend Magic Mind to my friends because it's a clean and gentle way to wake up in the morning, while also boosting your memory and focus with natural ingredients. So if you're caffeine sensitive like me and also like the additional benefits, check them out at magicmind.com/cookiescrime. You can also use my discount code cookiescrime to get up to 56% off your first subscription or 20% off your first one-time purchase. And going back to what I said about nurses having a very tough, demanding job, that goes for everyone, right? Not just Beata, but the people that have to work with Beata and Maya. I don't think anyone likes feeling berated. I don't think people like being told something as if they are not a medical professional themselves and they didn't go through years of education and training for this job. And they themselves are probably stressed from the day and have seen a lot of cases like this. I feel like it's probably very hard not to get jaded in this type of job. But I wish they could empathize with what this mother is feeling. Imagine that your child is experiencing this pain. Regardless of whether you believe it or not, they are your child. And you've gone through several doctors to find out what is wrong. You do everything you can by documenting and talking to multiple professionals. You think you figured it out, but everything hits rock bottom once again. And this mother is frustrated from seeing her daughter in pain. So even after disagreeing with Maya's medical diagnosis, the hospital does end up giving Maya a low dose of ketamine, which in the past her parents knew that didn't work for her. And when the doctors at Johns Hopkins saw it wasn't working for her, and they believed it should have because ketamine is pretty strong, they began to question if she really had complex regional pain syndrome. Maybe it was something else, not related to Maya at all. When Beata saw that Maya was not getting any better, she understandably gets upset that her daughter is still suffering. Heated conversations are had between her and the staff, and Beata thinks it's best for Maya to get treated elsewhere. That's when doctors tell them that if they try to leave, they will call security on them. One of the doctors ends up calling the child abuse hotline to do an investigation on the family. A few days later, Dr. Sally Smith, a child abuse physician, comes in and questions Maya and Jack, who are present. She comes in and doesn't announce who she is, by the way, so they just believe her to be another hospital physician or hospital staff. She asked Jack why he would allow someone to give Maya such high dosages of ketamine day after day, and he responds with, "That's what was prescribed to her by their doctor." So, to summarize what's going on at this point, the doctors at the hospital don't know what CRPS is. They are really hung up by the dosage of ketamine that Maya has been given, and they do not like Beata. After Dr. Sally Smith's informal interview with Maya and Jack, and after evaluating their interactions with Beata, they concluded that Beata showed ample evidence of having Munchausen by proxy, and that she was committing medical child abuse. Munchausen by proxy is a psychological disorder marked by attention-seeking behavior by a caregiver, often a mother. They try to get attention through the person they're caring for by making up or exaggerating an illness. The most famous case of Munchausen by proxy is the case of Gypsy Rose. The characteristics of someone with Munchausen by proxy are that there are usually a parent, which Beata is, a healthcare professional, which Beata is. They're very friendly and cooperative with medical staff, which, according to them, she is not, and appears to be concerned about their child, which, of course, she is. Are parents of kids with CRPS not? Other possible warning signs of Munchausen by proxy include the child has a history of many hospitalizations, often with a strange set of symptoms. Worsening of the child's symptoms generally is reported by the parent and is not witnessed by the hospital staff. The child's reported condition and symptoms do not agree with the results of tests, and the child's condition improves in the hospital, but symptoms recur when the child returns home. So, in my opinion, looking at these characteristics and warning signs, it's very vague, and I feel like it can be up for interpretation, especially if you're not educated in a certain disease or syndrome. And because of how vague it is, it feels like a major deciding factor in diagnosing someone with this is bias. Because looking at these characteristics in a different perception, I feel like these are characteristics of a very concerned parent with a child that has a disease that they are unsure of and doctors are unsure of, which can happen. I know we're in 2023 and we are way more medically advanced and knowledgeable than we have ever been, but doctors don't always get it right and we don't always get it right. And unfortunately, no one can ever truly know what someone else is feeling or how much pain they're going through. So I feel like the hospital staff is being biased. I mean, they do not like Beata. The words they used to describe her are words that people with hurt feelings use. They are basically calling her crazy in a more long-winded way. And I get the vibe that there is some underlying sexism going on here. I don't feel like men are often described as belligerent or controlling, right? They are just being assertive. After everything they've been through, Beata will not take no for an answer when it comes to helping her child. And it's truly disheartening to hear from doctors that they just saw it as pushy. I mean, honestly, we could go on and on about how women always get the short end of the stick, especially when it comes to showing emotions. So one day, while Jack is at the hospital with Maya, a nurse tells him he has to leave, and Maya is now under state custody. The Kowalskis hire a lawyer, Deborah Salisbury, to help them. Deborah has dealt with these types of cases many times because this actually happens a lot. specifically in their county. The interesting thing about Florida's child welfare system is that it's privatized, meaning it's no longer the government's responsibility. It's the responsibilities of private agencies and nonprofits, which also means companies can make money off of child welfare. Florida is only one of two states that have privatized child welfare. The idea is that privatizing it will make the system more efficient and they'll have more resources. But of course, there's a lot of criticism. A government should be able to take care of their children in their system. And privatizing anything means there's an incentive to make money off of it. It was mandated in 1998 that all services become privatized. Five original pilot projects were launched at the beginning of the mandate, and four out of five of them failed. The one that saw success was in Sarasota County, the county where the Kowalskis live.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
In 2004, the Department of Children and Families saw overcrowding in foster care and lack of supervisors in Pinellas County. The children in this county of Pinellas County, which is where the hospital also is almost 2.5 times more likely to be removed from their families compared to the rest of the state. So Maya is left at the hospital and is not allowed to see her parents. While she's there, her condition is not taken seriously, since they believe her mom has Munchausen by proxy. When Maya tells them about her pain, they tell her it's not real or that she's making it up. Maya even overhears staff outside her door telling other staff members that she's lying and making it all up. Without the proper care, her condition is worsening. In the meantime, Beata is still trying to manage Maya's case in any way she can. She consistently calls the hospitals and makes sure Maya is being given care. And Beata is only allowed to talk to the nurses. She's not able to talk to her daughter, so she's constantly being shut down by these nurses, and she gets really frustrated with the staff and lets them know it. And this causes a lot of tension between Beata and Jack, because in terms of the custody and child protective services, it's not helping that the staff believe Beata is harassing them. Jack believes that Beata should back down and not stir up any more issues with the hospital. She feels she has the right to know what's happening with her daughter and getting her the care that she needs. As tensions rise between Beata and the hospital, a judge orders a no contact between Beata and Maya. I really feel for both the parents because I understand where both of them are coming from. Beata is a very strong-headed woman and she's very knowledgeable. I don't think any mother can really understand that they are not allowed to take care of their child anymore. How are you supposed to process that? That is really tough. I mean, again, I can only imagine because I don't have my own kid. That's just something that I can't even fathom. And I also understand where Jack is coming from because he just wants to have his daughter back. And he is going to do whatever the state tells him to, whatever these people at the hospital tell him to, the lawyer tells him to, because he just wants to have his daughter back. So what is the right or wrong way to act? I don't think there is. And who's to really know? After 4 days, Jack is finally allowed to see Maya, and he sees that she's not getting any better. I think at this point, she's no longer receiving any ketamine treatment because it was the goal of the doctors at the hospital to wean her off it. And after discussing this with Dr. Kirkpatrick, he informs the parents that considering the severity of Maya's CRPS, her prolonged pain could lead to death. One day, Beata is finally allowed to speak with Maya on the phone under supervision. She's not allowed to talk about the case or her treatment and is told to keep it to how she's doing and just catching up. Of course, this call is also recorded by Beata, and honestly, it is so heartbreaking. Beata's voice immediately just sounds like it's a relief from finally being able to talk to her daughter. And she says, "How are you doing, my sunshine?" I'm sure I have my biases at this point, but listening to this conversation, Beata genuinely cares about her daughter. And Maya just wants to get home to her mom. From these conversations, how do you not see that this is just a loving relationship between a mother and daughter? The woman who is supervising the call was social worker Kathy Betty. Betty previously managed foster care children for the Suncoast Center for Community Health. She had been arrested and charged with one felony count of child abuse. In order to try and control a 10-year-old boy's behavior, she grabbed his head, causing him to fall down. She then kept him down by putting her knees on his chest. When he told her he couldn't breathe, she said, "Yes, you can." Another therapist with her covered the boy's face with a towel. The charges were later dropped. How do these people get jobs that allow them to interact with children when they obviously hate kids? Again, like, these people sound like they're so jaded from their job. I'm sure somewhere in their career, they have come across some truly difficult children or children who were exaggerating something. But you never do that to a child. She wasn't just about controlling this boy's behavior. She wanted to retaliate in a way. She was tired of children at this point when she held this child down, for sure. Same with the therapist that covered the boy's face with a towel. They were exhausted and fed up with children. And at that point, they should have not been dealing with children. And it's funny that Kathy Betty gets to sit in this hospital room with a child while her mother is away. The irony of that is insane. So Jack Googled Kathy Betty, and that is how they know this information of her being arrested at some point. And knowing this information, Beata and Jack become concerned with who is around their daughter. Every time they get to have a call with Maya and find out Betty is supervising the call, they feel distress. And they were right to. As a part of the investigation of Beata, Betty needed to take pictures of Maya. She was stripped to her sports bra and shorts and was photographed without the consent of her parents. Maya was very uncomfortable with this and was held down to be photographed. After one call where Maya was crying and telling her mom she wanted to go home, Beata expressed some frustrations and Betty tries to have Beata's calling privileges revoked. All of this is considered in Beata's investigation. In addition to all the information they have, Jack is also interviewed by a detective. In this interview, they're going at him hard with accusatory-style questions. It sounds like a police interrogation with a criminal. He's asked if he really cares for his children and if he actually puts them first. He's also asked would he put his children in front of his wife. And ultimately, if Maya were released to him under the condition that Maya have no contact with her mother, would he do it? In desperation to get his daughter back, he says yes. So after this interview, he goes home and tells Beata about the interview, and of course, she feels betrayed. She feels like even her husband has turned against her, even though he really never agreed with the way she handled this whole situation. But this weighs really heavy on her. After several court hearings that always resulted in the judge siding with the hospital, Beata asked the judge if she could simply hug her daughter, and he said no, she can't. At this point, it's been close to 3 months since Beata and Maya have seen each other, with phone conversations only occurring from time to time. As a child, that has to be really tough, being away from home and from your parents. In that time, maybe she even forgot how her mother looked. Beata, too, feels completely defeated. All she wanted to do was help her child. Then the hospital took that away from her, took her daughter away from her. And when she was told she wouldn't even be able to touch her daughter to give her daughter some comfort, to give herself some comfort, she had reached her breaking point. A few days later, after 87 days without her daughter, Beata hung herself inside her garage. Before she died, she sent an email to the judge. It said, "Your heart is made out of iceberg. By taking the side of the ACH and DCF, you have destroyed my family, my marriage. You have put us in bankruptcy, and you still denied me to see my daughter in court today. Further, you let them continue to destroy her even more, slowly each day. I hope you will take responsibility for my daughter's physical reconditioning, worsening of her CRPS that eventually will lead to her slow, painful death." She also wrote an email to family and friends. It read, "Please take care of Maya and tell her I love her every day." So these are just excerpts taken from the email. The emails were much longer than this, but reading this is so hard. I'm like laughing out of discomfort, but watching the documentary and hearing from the family members describe this moment is just so disheartening. Part of you just feels like all this could have been avoided. And I honestly believe that if she was able to see her daughter in court that day, or even hug her daughter, especially hug her daughter, this wouldn't have happened. I feel like it would have held her over at least for a little bit longer. Oh, and if you thought this part enraged me, just wait until you hear the text messages between two doctors at the hospital. So these are the text messages. Dr. 1, "Learned today that ketamine girl's mom committed suicide yesterday. Sorry to say, my prediction was correct." Dr. 2, "OMG, this is terrible. I know we did the right thing, but this is really fucked up. I feel bad." Dr. Number 1, "I had another mother do the same thing. We definitely did the right thing for the child." So you did the right thing for the child. You mean the girl you endearingly call ketamine girl? This whole conversation is laced with ego and lack of empathy to me. None of this conversation was about Maya or her mother. It was about them. Like saying, "My prediction was correct. I know we did the right thing. We definitely did the right thing." They really wanted to feel like they were the good guys, but I'm sorry. All I can read is conceitedness and jadedness. And I get it. These were supposed to be private messages. I'm sure I have some messages that if they were put out, I would feel absolutely bad. But sometimes we need to see these things, because these words are saying one thing, that they were looking out for the child, but the way they are saying it says something completely different. There is so much judgment in these messages. Them calling her ketamine girl is consistent with how Maya said that the staff were treating her. They wouldn't believe her. They would try to turn her against her mother. They can't even call her by her first name. She's ketamine girl. That is so infuriating to me. These are two doctors gossiping like they are high schoolers and thinking that they're the shit. Ugh! So Maya was allowed to go to her mother's funeral, but it was barely enough time for her to be with her family and to mourn. Thankfully, shortly after Beata's death, some things were expedited. Jack was able to take Maya to a specialist in Rhode Island to get another diagnosis. She was diagnosed once again with complex regional pain syndrome. Jack was able to get the custody of his daughter back. The family without Beata did their best to find some normalcy. Maya is still affected by her syndrome, but they do the best they can. As she says, some days she's able to deal with the pain fine, and other days look worse. A couple years later, a reporter named Daphne Chen was reviewing child welfare in Sarasota when she came across the story of the Kowalski family. She interviewed the family and Dr. Sally Smith, who doubled down on the fact that she had done nothing wrong. So Chen posted the article and thinks she's done with it and moves on. But then she starts receiving emails and phone calls from a good amount of other families who have very similar stories that all center around Dr. Sally Smith and how they were wronged by her and the system. Some of these parents were put in jail, lost their jobs, or had to file for bankruptcy from legal fees because of the mistake of these physicians and hospital workers who can break up families with a snap of their fingers. These families were all trying to help their children, but instead found themselves in a situation that would traumatize their kids more than they could have imagined. And the really sad thing is that when these families tried to seek legal help, they were all told to just be compliant. No matter how they felt, no matter how wronged they were, they just needed to be compliant if they ever wanted to see their kids again. These parents were encouraged to sign a case plan. This case plan is basically a checklist of things they needed to do and provide, such as proof of employment, taking anger management, couples counseling, in order for them to get their child back. But the sneaky thing about this plan is that you're basically admitting fault to the abuse that took your child away in the first place, and two, you're releasing the hospital and the agencies of any liability. Beata knew what the hospital was trying to do and did not agree to a case plan, which is why the Kowalskis were able to file a lawsuit against Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. All of Beata's documentations, all of the evidence she kept, and her knowledge in the case to know that she shouldn't sign that case plan is the reason why her family can file a lawsuit now. This woman was thinking ahead of all of us. So this lawsuit trial started recently in late September 2023, so just a month ago, just a few months ago, and even getting this case started has been a hurdle for them. Johns Hopkins has some powerful people behind them and a lot of money behind them that had been postponing this trial, but they were finally able to push it through. This whole process continues to be traumatizing for the family, because after 5-ish years, they still have to relive this whole experience to get justice for Maya and her mother. In a deposition given by Maya, she was asked why she didn't like going to hospitals and doctors anymore. And this was probably asked by an attorney who was trying to prove she was faking an illness. And an infuriated Maya reminds them that the last time she was in a hospital, she was a young girl taken away from her family, imprisoned against her will, and her mother had killed herself because of it. She is crying and so distraught, and she said straight to them that they had the audacity to ask her that, knowing what she had been through. Honestly, I am so proud of her for sticking up for herself and showing these attorneys how ridiculous they are being. Just hearing the way she speaks, being interviewed, and in her deposition, you can see that she had to grow up so fast. She is so mature, she is so well-spoken. She speaks her thoughts and her mind and everything that happened so clearly. And I feel so bad that she has to do that for herself, but I'm so glad she is raising her voice and is speaking up for herself. Jack Kowalski, on behalf of himself, Maya, Kyle, and the estate of Beata, is suing Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital for $220 million, $55 million in compensatory damages, and $165 million in punitive damages. They are seeking these damages for the claims of battery, false imprisonment, fraudulent billing, and emotional distress that led to the suicide of Beata. This fraudulent billing claim came after they discovered that Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital was still billing the Kowalskis insurance for treatment of CRPS, which they denied Maya even had. I swear, the healthcare industry in the US is so sketch. It is so for profit. Hospitals literally have to think about making money and making a profit. I mean, this is also why insurance companies don't want to put out, because hospitals and medical facilities can take advantage of them. The family had also already settled their lawsuit against Dr. Sally Smith and her employer, Suncoast Advocacy Services. So far in this trial, I'm getting a glimpse of both sides. The defense, which is the hospital, are still claiming they have done nothing wrong and are still pushing the narrative that Maya does not have CRPS, or that if she does, she shouldn't have been given such high doses of ketamine or any, or that if she does have it, she shouldn't have been given such high doses of ketamine or any ketamine at all. They also brought up that after her hospitalization, she eventually was off ketamine and only needed light medication afterwards. Again, meaning she wasn't actually sick or that she didn't need the ketamine her family insisted of her having. But upon hearing Maya speak, the jury is in tears. Some are reaching for Kleenexes, hearing the details of her pain and suffering. I mean, I would be too. I would be bawling hard in that room that they would have to remove me. It would be so obvious what side I was on. I can only imagine how infuriating it is for Maya, for doctors and people to stand there and talk about what she does or does not feel, as if her body is not her own. That there is a room full of medical professionals who are telling her if her symptoms were imaginary or not. How dismissive are they all to the fact that their carelessness and ego led to her mother's suicide? And she still has to sit there composed. The rage I feel for her and her family, I 100% believe the Kowalskis should be awarded this money. I can understand to an extent that the hospital staff had to ensure their patients are safe, but they did a horrible job in doing so. Mistakes happen and the right choices aren't always made. And some can argue that it's better to be safe than sorry, but they have to admit to their mistake here. They let their place of power and ego destroy a whole family. Multiple at that. It's apparent that in their texts to each other and how they spoke to Maya about her own mother in front of her, that they thought less of this family and they thought they knew it all. Minus what CRPS is. Honestly, I think that they liked punishing Beata in this way because of the way she spoke to them, not realizing they were dealing with an educated mother who just desperately wanted to take the pain away from her daughter. They showed no kindness, no empathy, or compassion while working with a child, which in that occupation, I feel like you need it more so than others. I feel like this could have been avoided. So, as I mentioned before, I researched and covered this case before a verdict was made by the jury. So the jury has reached a verdict and they have found that Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital is responsible for all of the claims. The 6-person jury deliberated for 2 days and found that the hospital is liable for all 7 claims. That includes false imprisonment, battery, negligence, initial infliction of emotional distress, and intentional infliction of emotional distress causing death. When the verdict was read, Maya bursted into tears, and so did her brother. So they originally sought out $220 million. They were compensated $211 million. But after deliberating again in the evening, they will receive an additional $50 million for a total of $261 million. Let me tell you, I cried. I was so happy for them. Maya is now 17 years old, and while she was waiting to hear the verdict, she was clutching her mother's rosary. And you can just tell that the cry she gave out was such a release because this has been over their heads for 5 years. They have been seeking justice for 5 years. Beata, in the end, still protected her child. She absolutely was looking after her child in more than one way because even though she's not here, she has brought justice to not only her daughter and her family, but to so many families. The hospital and the court have been pushing this trial for so freaking long, and they were finally able to get it. I really hope for their family that they can finally rest a little bit easier because they've got their justice for not only themselves, but for Beata and for all of the families out there who were also wronged by the system and didn't get their justice. And I really hope that this changes something in the system. Because it is obviously so broken. That money, although it is great, can never bring back Maya's mother. But I am so glad that there is still somewhat of a happy ending to all of this, and that the family can find some peace. And that is the case from Take Care of Maya. I'm so glad I got to end this episode on a much happier note because, I feel so relieved and I feel so happy for the family. And honestly, that hospital and Dr. Sally Smith can suck a fat dick. That's all I'm gonna say. And so now we are going to transition over to cookies and crime trivia. So going back to that delicious cookie I had from Magnolia's Bakery. Magnolia's Bakery is now a chain, but it was founded in New York City. That was the first time I ever had Magnolia's Bakery. They opened in 1966 and they became very popular. So popular that it has had a few mentions in TV shows and movies. The bakery was actually featured in a major television show that is based in the city of New York City. Can you guess what that show is? Is it A, Sex and the City, B, Friends, C, 30 Rock, or D, Gossip Girl? I'll give you 5 seconds. The answer is A, Sex and the City. I have never watched an episode of Sex and the City. I've heard that it's an amazing show. I've just never caught on to it. But I can see this bakery being in that show. They are the same aesthetic. Now for the crime trivia we are going to learn today. Let's talk about legal jargon. So the Kowalski family was seeking damages from the hospital, but there are different types of damages. Specifically in this case, we talk about compensatory and punitive damages. They can seem very similar, but they are not the same. But which damage is designed to give justice to the plaintiff after being wronged? Is it compensatory damages or punitive damages? I will give you 5 seconds. The damage that is designed to give justice to the plaintiff after being wronged is compensatory damages. Punitive damages are designed to prevent others from being hurt by the same or similar action. And simply, it is to punish the defense for what they did. So typically when suing a party, they are going for compensatory damages, but not all judges allow somebody to seek punitive damages. And that was also something that was causing this trial to be put on pause, was that they were trying to decide whether the family was able to seek punitive damages, which in the end, they were allowed to. The more you know. So that's it for this episode. Not gonna lie, this one was a very emotional one for me, but I am glad that I got to educate myself on this a little bit and I got to share it with you all. And if you are a fan of Cookies and Crime, make sure to subscribe and follow so you can be one of the first people to listen to new episodes when they come out. Merch is also available on the website. Christmas is around the corner. Maybe give yourself a gift or someone you love who loves cookies and crime a gift. Episodes come out bi-weekly, and I will talk to you guys next time. Stay safe out there.